Hey everyone, it's Cardiff, and welcome to The Indicator from Planet Money. Today on the show, friends of The Indicator look ahead to 2019, part two. Two more of our favorite guests from the year that was tell us about the indicators they'll be looking at next year. Plus, a couple more recommendations for a favorite holiday beverage right after the break.
Support for NPR and the following message come from Allstate, which now offers life insurance that pays out like a monthly paycheck. Allstate Monthly Income Term Life Insurance, issued by Allstate Assurance Company, Northbrook, Illinois. Not available in New York. Support also comes from Capital One. Capital One's indicator is zero, because they offer accounts with zero fees or minimums, and they offer accounts that can be opened from anywhere in 5 minutes. Capital One, what's in your wallet? Capital One N.A.
Okay, first up, our old pal Josh Barrow. Josh is the business and economics columnist at New York Magazine, and he's the host of KCRW's Left, Right, and Center. He joins us in our New York studios. Josh Barrow, welcome back to the show.
Absolutely. Good to be back here.
Okay, so because we like to keep our priorities straight, let's go to the important question first. What is your favorite holiday beverage?
It's eggnog, but it's good eggnog.
Okay.
I mean, the thing is, you get a lot of, like, excessively sort of, like, cloyingly creamy eggnog. Eggnog should be booze forward. It should taste like whiskey.
Okay, what's great about this is that Martha Gimbel's holiday beverage was also eggnog, but she's very much in the heavy on the nutmeg camp. What about you?
Well, I like nutmeg. Yeah, no, it should definitely have spices, and nutmeg is the key spice for eggnog. But the key thing is it should taste like bourbon.
Should taste like bourbon.
Yeah.
Okay, so booze forward.
Yes.
Okay, great. And what indicator are you going to be looking at in 2019?
I'm going to be looking at oil prices, but like everybody else, I'm going to be having difficulty figuring out what they mean.
Why is that?
Well, because oil prices are a weird thing. They're both a cause of economic conditions and they're a reflection of economic conditions. When oil prices go up for exogenous reasons, like there's a war in a place where a lot of oil is produced or something of that nature, that causes a drag on the global economy. Energy gets more expensive. That makes it more expensive for people to do all of the things they want to do, and that reduces output. On the other hand, when things happen that are going to cause output to slow down, that reduces the demand for oil, and that can cause oil prices to fall. So it's really difficult to figure out from the sign of a change in oil prices what that means about the economy, because high oil prices can push the economy down, but a falling economy can push oil prices down.
Yeah, and something to note here also, and which illustrates your point, is that the oil price started climbing quite aggressively, starting roughly last summer, the summer of 2017. And it seemed until this summer like it was just going to keep climbing, right? It didn't, and one of the reasons was that actually everybody, including people, you know, analysts who watched the oil market very carefully, ended up underestimating how much more the frackers in the U.S. would supply. But actually, they supplied quite a bit, and it seems like that being part of the reason that the oil price is now falling is coming at a useful time in which, like, the rest of the global economy is decelerating. There's a lot of worries that in the U.S., the economy is also going to be decelerating into the new year. But the fact that oil prices are coming down now might at least be a little bit of a buffer.
Well, there are two stories you can tell about the falling oil price. One is the story you told, which is the happy story, that basically oil prices were going up last year because the economy looked good, and that was going to be strong for demand for oil. And in order to meet all that demand or to bring demand in line with supply, you're going to need a higher price. And then as we learned over the last year that actually we were going to be able to produce more oil than we thought, the price didn't need to go up so much to bring demand in line with supply, and prices could come back down again. And so that's a happy story. It should provide a real boost to the economy because people are not going to have to pay as much for fuel as they thought they were going to, and we shouldn't worry about the falling oil price. There's a worse story you can tell, though, which is that oil prices are falling because there's been a reassessment of global demand for oil because there's been a reassessment of global economic growth prospects. And we do see some other signs in this direction, particularly the stock market turmoil that we've seen, that suggest that economic performance is not going to be as strong as market participants thought it was going to be a few months ago. Not necessarily a recession, but at least a slowdown in global economic growth. And the fall in oil prices would also be consistent with that, that there's not going to be as much demand as people thought there was going to be. And that's why the supply of oil is going to be more sufficient than we thought. that's a much more negative story for the global economy, and you can really make a case for either of them.
Yeah, that's also partly why this is a good choice. It makes following the oil price so much fun, precisely because you have to disentangle all of these different variables.
And also because you can almost always argue that the trends in the oil price support what your pre-existing beliefs were about the global economy.
The perfect confirmation bias indicator.
Yes.
Josh Brill, thanks, man.
Thanks, Cardiff.
And next up, economist Jennifer Doliak from Texas A&M University. And she speaks with us from a hotel in Austin where she's working on a new paper. So, Jennifer, I don't want to know anything about indicators until you've told us all what your favorite holiday drink is.
My holiday beverage of choice is sparkling wine, Prosecco, champagne, anything with bubbles.
Sparkling wine, Prosecco, and what do you like to pair it with?
Oh.
If anything.
Yeah, that seems unnecessary, but you mean like food?
Or, yeah, anything. Food, music, friends,
yeah.
Company, whatever.
Good friends. Good company is
good
always
friends,
the right
good
answer.
Company.
Yes.
And so while you're drinking your Prosecco and you've got your friends over and you're talking about the year to come, what indicator are you telling them is going to be super important to follow in 2019?
Yeah, so this is a bit inside baseball, but I've been paying close attention to conversations within the economics profession about how to make our profession more inclusive. So like many industries, we've been having a bit of a Me Too moment. Just last week, news broke about sexual harassment by Roland Fryer, a big name professor at Harvard, and we've been having related conversations for about a year or so now. So the indicator I'll be watching closely in 2019 is diversity in economics.
Diversity in economics.
Including things like, you know, the share of PhD students and seminar speakers and keynote speakers at conferences who are women and underrepresented minorities.
Yeah, I was going to ask, like, what's a good way to keep, like, what's a good quantifiable way to keep track of whether or not the economics profession is becoming more diverse?
Right. And it's tricky, obviously. So all of those things I think are good metrics, partly because I think it's a way that we can all acknowledge that we play a role in deciding who has access to networks and opportunities when we make invites for various things. It gives us a chance to kind of work from the ground up to open doors for a broader set of people. So I'm going to be bugging my fellow economists to do better on those metrics in the year ahead.
That's great. And I also think we can all agree that a more inclusive economics profession would be good for its own sake. But let me also ask you, how do you think that lack of inclusiveness affects the actual work, what's produced by the economics profession?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So this is important because I think we will come up with better ideas and are more likely to find good answers if we have a broader set of people at the table asking a broader range of questions and bringing their own life experiences to the topics they're studying. So the more narrow the set of experiences that people have, the more narrow the set of things they're going to be thinking about. And we need as many good ideas as we can get.
Yeah, I have what I think is a tough question for anybody. It might be impossible to answer right now. But why do you think that the lack of inclusiveness has persisted for so long in economics?
You know, I think economists, we just really trust markets. And we like the idea that that markets are efficient and that this is, you know, the best ideas naturally rise to the top. And of course, we also know all the ways in which markets can fail.
Yeah.
So it's not like we're completely naive about such things. But I think we really do trust that that the best people and the best ideas will naturally find a way to break through. And that's, I think, probably left us a little slower than other academic disciplines to address these problems.
Jennifer Doliak, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And that's it. Thanks to Sameya, Jared, Martha, Josh, and Jennifer for being such great guests this year and for prepping us for 2019. And if you want more end-of-year reminiscing, our friends at The Economist invited me onto their Money Talks podcast to participate in their Christmas Jamboree episode. So you should check that out as well. Today's Indicator episode was produced by Darius Rafieyan and edited by Patty Hirsch. The Indicator is a production of NPR. Have a great weekend.